Trump said some magic words, and these words to make our country great again. These words make the politicians run and reporters cry. Say them loud if you want to win. Trump said we gotta grab him by the pussy. We gotta grab him by the pussy. We gotta grab him by the pussy if we wanna win. Now as a culturist, Trump says Islam is dangerous, and he says the United States is not Mexico. Lips out, these words are racist. They make children cry. Tell them it's a culturist fact, and they should know. We gotta grab by the pussy. We gotta grab by the pussy. We gotta grab by the pussy if we wanna live. Now black athletes always claim to be real tough guys. Say what you want, no excuses. They came to win. But off the court said they can't compete because of white's racist words. So I have a message for my black friends. You gotta grab by the pussy, you gotta grab by the pussy, you gotta grab by the pussy if you wanna win. Now little leftist girly men are afraid of words. They get triggered and retreat to safety spaces. If we ever want to redeem their balls, we have to scream harsh truth into their stupid, faggy, curly faces. Tell them you gotta grab them by the pussy, you gotta grab them by the pussy, you gotta grab them by the pussy if you wanna win. You gotta grab them by the pussy, you gotta grab them by the pussy, you gotta grab them by the pussy. And by pussy, I mean you. And by pussy, I mean you. And by pussy, I mean you. And you. And you, 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 and you. Grab 'em.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with John Kenneth Press.
Hello.
He is an advocate of culturism. John, it's great talking to you.
It's wonderful to be here. And Pillyder's here also, right?
Hi.
Yeah, Pillyder's here.
It's nice to talk to you too. I'm excited to learn more about culturism.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you and start a discussion with your audience.
So, John, we met in person back in December in Santa Monica.
My hometown. We did.
And I grew up in that area, too. Not in Santa Monica, but in, Westwood and Brentwood.
Uh-huh.
How has the area changed since you were growing up there and how it relates to the topics we're discussing?
Well, the area has changed, and also the entire culture has, of course, changed. I grew up. I was born in 1964, so I graduated high school in 1982. So, this was under Reagan. It was an entirely different culture back then. I mean, we started in 1965 with open borders, third world immigration mass to this nation. And in 1982, it really hadn't really hit us. There was still freedom of speech. And demographically, Santa Monica was, your prototypical Beach Boys, white blonde hair town. And
you were kind of joking that, back in the beach, you stood out back then for not being blonde enough, but now, on the beach today, you're the only white person there.
Yeah, right, right. That's a good barometer of how far we've swung, right? I have curly hair. I'm Jewish by ancestry, and even in the punk movement when everyone was spiking their hair, I had curly hair, right? When everyone was blonde hair, blue eyes. Well, my sister has long blonde hair and blue eyes, but I have, as you know, because we've met, curly hair. So yeah, back then I was an oddity, and I'm still an oddity.
You were in a punk band too. I looked on your music page.
I was in a few punk bands, but the one that's featured on my music page, because I have a personal website, it's called The Patriots, and The Patriots were a great band. Mm.
You've also done some recent music. I saw that song you did, Grab 'Em by the Pussy.
Yeah, that's a my newest song. I've only done two songs at my website, culturism.us, but that's my most recent one. And I love the phrase, Grab 'Em by the Pussy. I mean, we have to do that. Just the vulgarity of that phrase, right? The fact that it makes people uncomfortable. Well, good. We've got to start making people uncomfortable. And that phrase got a lot of attention. And when I look around, as you see, if you see in the video, which is comical, I see pussies everywhere, right? Jeb Bush. Oh, Paul Ryan, big pussy. We got, you know, not just on the left, not just, you know, pussies like Obama and, you know, all these people that, as we say, butt hurt, that start to cry when they lose the election. I mean, people on the right. You say one off-color thing, and, you know, they're, like, condemning you and saying, you know, that's not acceptable. We can't talk like that. Oh, shut up, pussy. We have talked like that. We want to talk like that again. That's how we talk, you know? So, yeah, my newest song is Grab 'Em by the Pussy, and it's praising that phrase from Trump.
With your political background, you ran the Brooklyn Tea Party and protested against the Ground Zero Mosque. You were telling me something interesting. Within the Tea Party movement, there was another faction that was less interested in culture, and their main focus was just like economics.
And that right. There are five boroughs in New York City, and we were Brooklyn, but there's also Manhattan and Staten Island. Those were the big ones. And Staten Island and Manhattan, good people, love them. I mean, we're all on the same side, right?
I would think Staten Island would be more conservative because that was like Trump's stronghold in the election, the primary and the final.
Well, they were. They took the official position. Look, here's the conflict, and you see this with conservatism a lot, right? The Manhattan people wanted the Tea Party message, taxed enough already, to be purely about economics. We want to shrink government. That's it. And I, as a culturist, I made the Brooklyn Tea Party culturist Brooklyn Tea Party. I mean, we talked about culture. We talked about Islam. We talked about Mexican immigration. And they said, no, we don't want to get off on that. That'll divide us. We just all need to be united behind less taxes. Well, to me, that's ridiculous. I mean, if you're going to have, you know, we're from California, as we've been talking about, massive third world immigration, and our schools become remedial English learning centers, and you have cultures that aren't very pro-education. I mean, that's going to destroy your economy. So, you know, if you really want to talk about economy, not just your taxes this week, not just, you know, our deficit, if you want to get to the root of it, it's cultural, right? It's cultural. And so we have to, even if we want to just be economic, we can't avoid talking about culture. So I'm like, we got to be culturists. We got to talk again about the Ground Zero Mosque, about immigration. And the Manhattan people were livid. They would have none of it. They thought that was dividing us. The Staten Island people, you're right. They're a little more conservative. So they're like, look, we can't be for you doing this, but we won't condemn it. Okay. We're just going to be like neutral parties, but we're not going to say, you know, yeah, we're cultures too. They went, you know, with the Manhattan people.
And I think within like the Tea Party, there's like a lot of business owners who support the Tea Party for like less regulation and taxes on business, but they tend to be very pro-immigration for economic reasons.
Right. And I mean, I really prioritize as a culturist, I prioritize the culture over the economy. And again, you know, ultimately you have to have a strong culture to have a strong economy. But, you know, if we have to choose between having cheap labor, you know, even a little inflation under Trump with protectionism and losing our culture, well, I know I want to keep our culture. I'd rather be poor and make things in America. I'd rather be a little bit poor and have this be America than, you know, sell out and, you know, have a little bit higher GDP increase for a few years, you know. So yeah, people do, they do focus on the economics. That's not, I'm a culturist.
With culturism, is it similar to a sort of like a colorblind civic nationalism, or does it take into account like the ethnic composition? Because I know you've written for Alternative Right, and they focus a lot on ethnic demographics, as opposed to like the view that we should have civic nationalism, which says that we should have a colorblind society and like unite as Americans. Is culturism closer to one of those, or is it sort of a nuanced, or it's not, or it's a different?
It is nuanced. Yeah, I was listening to your interview with Craig Johnson of Countercurrents. Is more what he might term alt-light, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not exactly civic nationalism. Look, it does take into account, and it can, and it, you know, culturism's different. China's culturism is different than ours, which is different than Saudi Arabia's. But just talking about the West now, our culturism is probably better served by being race blind. There are merits to talking about race. I mean, for example, inequality gets explained, and therefore it's not just a source of resentment all the time, right? But we do have to unite. There are terrible white people. There are great black people, patriotic black people. So I we can improve. So I believe that we're not going to unite racially because we're so diverse and we can't reverse that, but we can unite culturally. So in a way, again, it's more, it doesn't disavow, you know, that we should ever talk about race, but it's more focusing on culture. So in terms of racism, it's more sort of culturist alt-light. However, if I want to, again, contrast it to civic nationalism, which you asked about, well, civic nationalism is really this sort of, people have described it, Pat Buchanan and others, as this creed sort of deal, right? So we all men are created equal, platitude, democracy, process, this sort of thing where, you know, we believe in rights and individualism and you know, women's rights. So this becomes just a creed. But as a culturist, I would say that these creeds don't just float in space. These creeds are a product of a specific culture and history. That's Western culture. That's Western history, right? So we have Christianity and the Enlightenment. That's the roots of America. And I need people to celebrate. And you know, if you want to say that being people being white is part of this, okay, or the genetic propensities, okay. But to celebrate that the West is the best, right? That we create the best society that is most conducive to the human spirit flourishing. And if you're going to throw out the church, if you're going to throw out the Western history, if you're going to demonize it, well, you're going into a place where the creed will not exist.
And I think, yeah, that's the key thing is on an individual level, I mean, culturism can unite people of different backgrounds. But the question is, like, how do you deal with a place like L.A., which already is multicultural, and where basically it's been sort of overrun with this massive third-world immigration? Culturism is most effective when you have a society that's homogenous, and then maybe some new people come in and they assimilate. But I think a place like L.A. would be very difficult to implement culturism just because how much has changed.
Well, I think we have challenges. We have more challenges because we're not homogeneous, right? We do have ethnic racial diversity. That said, right, culturism is a science as well as an art, and there are many mechanisms by which culturism can work. So, for example, culturism is the opposite of multiculturalism. It's the opposite of multiculturalism. So when culturism is spread as a meme, I'm assuming you know about meme theory, mm-hmm. and it changes the culture, then every time we talk about negativity in a culture, let's say black thug life, that doesn't become racist. We can have a conversation about it. So just generally, the atmosphere in which we talk can open up. But now there are also mechanisms. For example, what is the biggest culturist institution we got going for 400 years? Schools. Right now, our schools are multicultural. So they tell people, like, it's almost genetic determinism. They tell people, like, your great grandfather's from Mexico, therefore you love Mexican culture, right? Well, we have to get rid of this multiculturalism, which teaches that all cultures are equally valid and wonderful, and get back to our tradition. Our tradition, just like the tradition of China, the tradition of Saudi Arabia, is to be culturist, to have culturist curriculum in our schools. And if we go back to our textbooks of like 1964, when I was born, you asked about Samar, we go back to those textbooks showed that the West is the best. These other countries are backwards, right? We're the new world. That's the old world. And if you teach people, generations of people, that you know, take pride, you escape that hellhole that was, you know, the primitive backward country that you came from, and you came to the first world, and you have a set of duties that that you're obligated to uphold because, you know, you're part of the West. So, I mean, politicians, Trump, he has the bully pulpit. So, I mean, you know, I mean, there's memes, there's institutions, there's advertising, there's the bully pulpit. I mean, there are many mechanisms. It's culture is an art by which you guide and change the society, right? The multiculturalism is just, they've been great. They've taken over our institutions, the Long March. We need to have our own Long March. We need to combat multiculturalism. We need to assert again that the West is great, right? Is California, is Los Angeles hopeless? No. You know, the first institutions for Mexican presence here in America were assimilationist. Right? The League of United Latin American Citizens started like in 1920 or something to promote the presence of Latin America. They were all about like, we're Americans, screw Mexico. I think that once we get our message straight, there are many ways to promulgate it, and culture can be changed.
You've been living in Korea and working as a college professor there. What are some of your observations on Korean society? And Korea is a homogenous society, unlike ours. How would you contrast Korea with the United States?
Well, I have to apologize. I am like a big sinophile. I like Chinese culture and cultures that come off of it. And I don't want to sound too rah-rah about Korea and, you know, make such a negative contrast with the West. But there is such a beauty to having to Korean culture. They are homogenous. You don't have this sensitivity about, you know, racism all the time, because, you know, people, they haven't had to deal with that. You have protests against the government that don't turn into, you know, ethnic strife, because that wouldn't even make sense in their context, right? You have high trust levels that come with, you know, as Robert Putnam was talking about, social capital. High trust levels. People trust each other. They do things for each other. There's safety in that culture.
That's absolutely true, because in a place like L.A., like, a lot of people talk about, like, anti-white hate crimes and stuff like that. Like, I've been around different people in Southern California, and I've rarely experienced like explicit anti-white racism per se, but my main critique of a society like Southern California is that it's very low trust. You don't have that sense of community and camaraderie that you would have in a high trust, more homogenous society.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can sort of, you know, it's beautiful. Did you hear that? I'm sure you heard the inaugural speech. And Trump said,
didn't his speechwriter also go to Samo High?
Went to Samo High, yeah. He's a proud Viking. But he said in his speech, he said, if you let patriotism into your heart, there is no room for prejudice. It was one of his lines. And, you know, I mean, it's very right. I mean, of course, prejudice will still exist in your heart even if you're a patriot. There's no question. It's a platitude. But we have in the West, you know, I mean, Obama pushes this, the left pushes this, such a fractured feeling, so much distrust, so much hostility. And, you know, rather than being proud to be all, you know, doing what we can to support the West in its glory, we've been pushing this distrust thing. And absolutely, you're right. When I walk around LA, I don't feel community with a lot of people. You know, even if we spoke the same language, there would be tendency for there to be distance between us. Oh my God, can I tell you something that happened to me?
Oh yeah.
I was in downtown LA, right? And I was seeing punk rock shows, and it was nighttime, and a
car.
This was when I went to a punk rock show 2 weekends ago. And a car came around the corner with tinted windows, slightly rolled down. There were three young black men in the car. And one of them shouted at a white woman, Trump is going to get y'all white people killed. And this was loud and hostile. And it was like, oh boy, I like you. I haven't, like, you know, personally experienced. Well, I mean, people say things that are snide, and, you know, they can make fun of white people and such, but you know, like real hostile sort of anti-white stuff until 2 weeks ago.
I did experience some of it in middle school, but not as much recently.
In middle school, we had anti-Mexican riots.
Oh, it's Sam. Oh, where yeah, you
John to Adams. John Adams, which is
that the one by Santa Monica College?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But this kind of thing is natural. I mean, okay, the statement that Trump made, right? If your heart, if there's patriotism in your heart, there's no room for prejudice. You know, it goes with this Hollywood thing. You know, you've got to be taught to hate. You know, we naturally get into groups. You don't have to be. We have biological predispositions. And as a culturist, you have to know this. You have to know that you need to manipulate songs and flags and ritual and story to get people to cohere. But naturally, we are divided. The feeling you have of, like, distrusting the other, chimpanzees go on raids and kill the other. So, I mean, that is something that is not just a social construct, as they say, that's deeply in us. So yeah, no, it takes a lot to have a patriotic thing unite everybody. I did another beautiful experience I had in downtown LA. I've been rediscovering downtown LA. Is I went to
I was there recently on my last trip too.
It's cool, yeah.
And they're also really like gentrifying it. Like everywhere you go, you see like a new skyscraper's going up.
Uh-huh. Unless you go to certain neighborhoods, then it's like, ooh. But I went to a Lakers game, and the Lakers do so much patriotism at their games. It's really heartwarming, right? The national anthem, and everybody, and you know the Lakers crowd is as diverse as California. And, you know, the players, thank you. were you know, standing during the national anthem. They had these two Latina soldiers come out. One of them had saved a life of somebody, and you know, she said something about we all being Americans together. I mean, it makes one emotional. We have to play with these sort of biological human mechanisms of belonging, because you're right, we're divided, so we have a lot of work to do. I mean, more than say China, where they just, you know, of course we're Chinese, look at each other, we don't have that, right? But we must strive against this sort of multicultural divide, resent, and work towards what we've traditionally done, which is push patriotism.
You were also saying that there's basically no political correctness in Korea. You were talking about an experience you had where some American tried to expose you for writing for Alternative Right, but basically the Koreans said, this guy's a qualified professor. They don't really care about what he writes about.
All right. I think of myself as an academic refugee, right? I mean, I almost got tossed out of university. I went to NYU, very liberal, and they tried to toss me out, but my work was good, so they couldn't. Because I said things that were impolitic, and you know, getting a job, they won't back me. So I am a refugee because they know my politics. So I end up in Korea, and even in Korea, where I felt totally, you know, I can say what I want. A guy, as you said, called, emailed the administration, emailed deans, emailed professors, trying to get me thrown out because, quote unquote, my views have no place in academia. And as soon as I heard about this, I'm like, this guy's got to be an American. And it was. I was right. And, you know, the administration backed me. I'll tell you an amazing thing, and this shouldn't be amazing, but it is. In Korea, I was allowed to speak to the Korean Association for Multicultural Education. They had a conference, KAME, the Korean Association for Multicultural Education, and the multiculturalists let me speak against multiculturalism. That is something that it should be normal, but that's just mind-blowing. In America, that would never happen.
And yeah, I mean, there really isn't no multiculturalism in Korea. I mean, unless you count, I mean, people there's some influence from American pop culture, but for the most part, it's a monocultural society.
It is, and the academics are pushing it. They like that, you know, the meme's gotten around, and they want to be modern like they perceive the West to be. So these are, the West is multicultural. We have to follow kind of zombie-like. But that's the government and academia as pressured, the government pressured by the UN. But if you talk to the people, they like their homogeneous. And, you know, the music, K-pop, it's all in Korean. The TV's in Korean. The movies are in Korean. People surf the internet on Korean websites. You know, they are ensconced in their own culture. And I don't think really wanting to break it up.
And even, like, North Korea, I mean, if you look at their communists and the original communists, like Trotsky, a lot of them were internationalists. But North Korea is a weird society. It's unusual because there's sort of a fusion of communism with nationalism. And there is this idea, like, don't the North Koreans, they see themselves as, like, the genuine Koreans and inheritors to the legacy of Korea?
They would say there's a book about North Korea, I think, called The Purest Race. And, I mean, they really preserve Korean heritage. And if you look at the idea of even having a dynasty, right? I mean, Korea was ruled by kings since time immemorial, pretty much, you know, in prehistory into 1910. So this idea of actually having a lineage that runs your nation is very Korean.
Well, I was actually looking at some of Mr. Press's other works, and I noticed there was a book on Japan, and me and Robert were interested on that. Basically, that it was something to do with, I guess, the word postmodern Japan looking in through, or some travel guide. I don't know what it's about. I don't have the book, but...
Right, no, that's the first book I actually wrote. It's all of my books kind
of
exist.
When was this written?
When was it? It was based on an event that actually happened in 2003. So going pretty far back, and it was not really written and published, I'm going to think, until 2009. I may be way off here, but, you know, books sometimes take a long time to gestate. And I said it was a true story. There, you know, developments in my mind get put into the book that, you know, weren't in my mind during the time it documents. But anyway, my that book, so I've looked at culturism from many angles, and that book is really, well, what happens if you go to straight individualism? What is it that undergirds an identity and about the corrosiveness of modernism on identity? So it's, you know, if you look at culturism, which is the extreme of, you know, keeping everybody together and united, and how do we get our identity? We're part of a group. The book Capsule, which is me in Japan talking about philosophy with a friend, it looks at, well, what is the opposite? What is individualism? Because in a way, like, you know, we don't even, as Americans, we don't even see our individualism. And we don't see how prominent it is for us and how corrosive it is until you go to Asia, until you spend time in China, Japan, and Korea. Then you see, wow, so there's this possibility of us having cohesion and a cohesive culture and a sense of loyalty to each other and a sense of trust and a sense of comradeship, you know, camaraderie. And, you know, we don't see it, so we're just like every man for himself.
Well, no, I'm just saying I can totally relate that because in my Asian studies class, you know, I was taught especially in Tokyo and some of the literature, you know, of modernist Japan stuff. Well, my professor would say, oh, there's a cohesive loyalty and connection to society and people become one with the city. However, just don't talk about race and love this multicultural Western thing. And I started to scratch my head on that and like, that's super odd because Mishima himself was a very, you know, ultra-nationalist. And some of these other modern Japanese writers like Murakami also have nostalgia about Japanese loyalty. And I find that especially confusing if you're coming from an Asian studies background, you're taught one thing in the multicultural background to like race and then another to say, well, you're not allowed to open about the racial part. It's you go as deep as you want, but not as far as to answer the sincerity. It's almost like Western people are kind of dishonest about talking about things.
Are you saying in your Asian studies courses, they didn't want to talk about the benefits of race?
Yes.
In Japan? Got it. Okay, good. And, you know, it's like we were talking about earlier, when I got attacked by that guy who was trying to get me kicked out of the university, you know, he's like, you said things that were racist. Well, first of all, you know, we've just had a discussion about there's a relationship between racism and culturism and nuance. And it's, you know, it's not black and white. We're intellectual. But it's also like when he said, you know, he said things that could be interpreted as racist. They're like, yeah, and like, the problem is what?
Yeah.
Like, okay, yeah. So, like, you know, because the concept of Minjok, they have one blood. They've always been proud.
Yes.
Now, the UN has made them recently change their textbooks in Korea.
And I think even more so, Koreans have this a strong sense of a Korean race or Korean ethnic group. I think what's interesting about Chinese history is historically China was multi-ethnic, but they have this history of absorbing these different groups into this one Han Chinese identity. But there's a lot of extreme regional diversity within China.
Yes, but the Han, you know, the vast majority, and they're very pro, like, we have a system, and it is Confucian, and you will respect it, and it is, like, they're not like, oh, well, look, part of our country can be Christian, and whatever you want to do, dude. It's like, no, we have hierarchy here. This is the leadership. And they stamp out, I mean, the Boxer Rebellion. More recently, you know, the limits on Christianity coming into the country. They are very aware that they have a particular culture, and they're promoting it. Even if you take out racial unity, I mean, they are culturist to an extreme. And you take Korea is culturist and they're racist, right? I mean, there's a spectrum of how these things interact. But and you know, even within the, you could say the racial diversity of China, I mean, these sort of like minutia of differences, they're like very aware that they're not black people, you know, like they're like, they're not hiring you. You're black.
No, I heard there were like anti-black African riots in China back in the late 80s.
I hadn't heard about this, but one thing that's interesting is, like, you know, there are crimes in, well, I don't know if I want to go there, but yeah, I haven't heard about this, but they're quite free to discriminate. They don't have the, I remember first coming to Korea and no foreigners.
No, I was talking about China, not Korea.
Yeah. In China, I didn't hear about anti-black riots.
How important do you see regional culture? A lot of different countries have these strong regional identities. I mean, we have like a regional culture in the South, in New England, the American Southwest. In Italy, uh-huh. Like Northern Italy has a very different culture than Southern Italy, Sicily, uh-huh. Even in France, Germany. Do uh-huh. you think the regional differences should be celebrated, encouraged?
Well, here's the deal. Culturism is quite nuanced, and I hope people go to culturism.us, and I've got videos and explanations and on particular topics like this one. Like, culturism is defined as it's promoting the traditional majority culture. It's the art and science of promoting the traditional majority culture. Now, what is the traditional majority culture? Well, in the West, that's Western culture, right? Writ large, right? But if we go to, say, Scotland, I'm just picking that out of a hat, Scotland has its own microculture, right? They almost seceded from England, right? And so within Scotland, I would say they should do Scottish culture. Now, is there conflict between Western culture and Scottish culture? Pretty much not. I mean, both Christian. And to the extent that Scotland said, well, you know, what we're going to do now is we're going to start, you know, instituting Sharia law. Well, that, I would not say, like, if you had a Muslim area, that kind of, like, local regionalism, not okay. Why not? Because Scotland is nestled firmly in the West, and it in Scotland cannot do things, according to culturist logic, that are anti-West. So,
and there's
so,
this, like, concept called kind of ethno-pluralism or right-wing multiculturalism, which encourages groups to have, like, a semi-autonomous regions. And that could include, like, immigrant groups. I think that's preferable to sort of what we have now. But that could still bring about problems and conflicts.
It would definitely. It would diminish us. It would, you know, we would be in a ghetto. And, you know, as much as possible. And, again, there are limits on how far this can go. I mean, even in China, cohesion should be your goal. The multicultural goal of dividing us and then causing resentment between groups, that is evil. That is something that nobody outside of the West even wants to play with. It's just common sense that that's dangerous.
How important do you see aesthetics to culturalism, especially architecture? What's interesting is you go to a lot of these American cities like San Francisco, New York, Boston, and they're basically, I mean, they're multicultural cities, but they do have their own unique identities through their architecture and the aesthetics of the city. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because there was a peak in globalism, and there was a peak in the modernist aesthetic at the sort of they coincided. And you see a lot of this in New York. With, like, the UN building, right, and the glass buildings and this kind of thing, you see more, I feel, an American flavor in the sort of museum architecture of Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York. You know, these old buildings that are very ornate. They're very, 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. They have statuary on them, this sort of thing. But you know, we move towards globalism, but that ebbed because I have news for the world. Globalism, modernism is not global. There's pretty much nothing that is global. And if you want to see, like, new buildings and this kind of thing, what you might call modernist buildings, they're not in America anymore. You don't see them much in Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York. Museums, those are museums of go to Asia. You need a strong, cohesive culture to have modernism, to the extent that we are, you know, we have these wonderful old buildings. I love them. They're so cool. They remind me of America. They have Western statues and adornments on them. But they are an indication that we are no longer having a culture. You talked about the multicultural populace, the culture that is able to support a sort of first world modernist, quote unquote, vision.
I don't think you have to be, like, a radical traditionalist to be a culturist. Just looking at, like, architecture and aesthetics, like, a lot of the sort of mid-century, space-age, futuristic architecture and, like, Art Deco architecture, which was futuristic for its time, like the Chrysler Building in New York, mm-hmm. That was very innovative, but it was uniquely American and unique to those societies. And then there's, like, the sort of Asian futuristic aesthetic that you would see in a city like Hong Kong. That's very futuristic, but uh-huh. It also represents the culture of the place. So I think you can be a culturist and a futurist at the same time.
Absolutely. You can't be a futurist if you're not culturist. You cannot be a futurist if you're not a culturist. If your culture is divided and you can't even have, like, sectors talk to each other and you have civil strife, you're not going to have the first world culture that is required to build the future.
And that's the thing is, like, in Korea, because they're homogenous, they can build these, like, self-enclosed, like, futuristic cities because they have that common bond. The problem with America is because it's a low-trust society, people go out and they move out to, like, these tract housing developments in the suburbs to kind of escape things.
Uh-huh.
But within a culturist society, in that sense of a strong social trust, you can have, like, these, like, futuristic self-enclosed cities like a lot of Asian countries do.
Yeah, you know what's very amazing is I live in these. I have two apartments. One apartment I live in Korea. It is enormous, and it's full of. It's a nice neighborhood. It's full of people that have money. I did not know, but about four big, huge, enormous apartment blocks away from us is government housing. Now, in America, government housing means ghetto crime. Don't go there. White flight, as you said, go, you know, get to the suburbs, run away. There, you have next to people that have means, you have government housing, and there is no, it's seamless. It's seamless. And I'm sure if you go into the schools there, then in that neighborhood, you're not having the divide that you would have. Oh my gosh, you know, if you try to make your school one third Latino, one third, or quarter Asian, quarter Latino, quarter black, quarter white. Right, that's going to be. It's going to have remedial education. It's going to have misunderstanding. It's going to have fights. It's not going to have, you know, just the pure focus on math and sciences. It's going to be all about the extraneous social difficulties you find yourself in. So it is. You're absolutely right. This sort of lack of decay, lack of this sort of horror decay, is directly linked to having trust, to having. Some sense of cohesion.
Yeah, I mean, that is also said too, that in this multicultural society, I mean, Jared Taylor will say this, that people will naturally segregate by race, that if given in proximity between, you know, black, white, and Asian in the lunchroom, mm-hmm. they will go to white, black, and Asian, stick in their groups. I mean, I have when I first did started doing Japanese in college level, then high school, it was about a few years ago, and it's just funny. Everybody in the room was Korean, and I, with one black kid and one other kid, and me were the outsiders, and we stick together as the multicultural outsiders, uh-huh. and uh-huh. everybody else was Korean. But I thought it was really funny. It was because before going to class, sometimes some of the Korean students would say, "Don't you find hiragana and katakana and some of this kanji really hard? Isn't it difficult? Why do the Japanese think like this?" And then they're like, "Have you ever been to Korea?" And it became more of a Korea culture class trying to study Japanese, and it was very funny.
Huh. Right. It's very hard. I mean, it's hard to take the position of another culture. So, yeah, it's natural. You're right. Like Jared Taylor says, if people come together, and this is why, you know, so many exchange students, they come from Korea to America to study English, but what do? They end up spending all their time with other Koreans speaking Korean.
Or learning Japanese.
recreating Korea, recreating their ancient hostility towards Japan. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think about Koreatown in L.A., and how would you compare it to Korea? I mean, parts of it are actually kind of run down.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, this is a huge stereotype, but the people that leave Korea are the people that are having trouble hacking it in Korea. And so it's not like you're upper crusty Korea now, but I can tell you that you can have too much culturism. You can have too much culturism. A lot of people in Korea consider Korea oppressive because it is so groupish. I mean, individualism, again, I will praise Korean culture and kind of use it to ding Western culture a little bit, but individualism is a glorious thing, and this is one thing that the West has brought to the world. The problem is you can't have individualism be sustainable unless you have morals. You can't have morals unless you have a cohesive culture, but if that culture gets too cohesive, it stifles individualism. I don't know if you can see this, it's like a cycle. You have too much individualism, that crashes you. Too much, cohesion, you don't have individualism, that also hurts you. So you've got a lot of Koreans that are coming to America because they feel in Korea they are constantly judged and watched. I think that there is right now, there's tremendous pressure for white women to show that they're not racist, and people to mix and go out with different races. If you're honest about race, it kind of creates, you know, it makes it less hip to be black, and it makes it less. We have no, again, less the resentment isn't justified against us, the fact that we've been successful, and it fills us a little bit with pride. I do believe that, at some level, it's kind of cool to put race concepts into dating. That said, again, you know, I search for unity, and mm-hmm. and I think that people right now are in this sort of multicultural zone where they're afraid. It's almost like it's racist to be with your own in a way, and yet people do not like. It's a big leap if you're going to start dating people in totally different cultures. It's going to be really weird. Like, you know, try to learn Spanish. Go home with your new girlfriend, and nobody looks like you, sounds like you, has the cultural mm-hmm. references you have. That's really difficult. And I think the attraction with the Asian thing is that we get the sense that Asia is a calm and ordered and rational and reasonable and not you know, philosophy, cultural space, and not filled with, you know, the sort of resentment that multiculturalism and feminism have brought to the West. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are cultural pressures that are pushing the kind of mixing that you're talking about. I don't think we should be completely unaware of race when we talk about this, but it's not just that it's random. It's not just that it's happening. It happens, as you say, with patterns, right? It happens with white men and Asian women. It happens with, as you maybe say, Israelis and white people. I haven't seen that much, but as you say, so there are these patterns, and we need to kind of be aware of them because it's a barometer for which culture is esteemed. You know, it's a barometer for which culture has status. And when a culture has status, all the women go that way. Mm. And it is evidence right now that to be black is to be able to instill sort of a hierarchy through shaming, through macho-ness and shaming, of which mm-hmm. you know, has the white person receding, which makes the white person less attractive, right? And so and that increases, of course, then sort of thug culture because that's what has status. That's what's getting women.
Familiar with Roger Devlin's speech from MPI where he talks about that theme?
No, I'm not. I'd love to. I watched the entire last MPI conference, but I didn't see that speech. I haven't seen him speak.
Well, I like Roger Devlin. He's a really nice person, especially his book, Sexual Utopia and Power, is interesting. And he will talk about the interracial relationships, especially between, I think it was the Scandinavian women and the Arabian, the dark-skinned Arab men, I think so,
uh-huh.
and
uh-huh.
about how they take advantage of what should be the Scandinavian men taking over their women. The same is happening, you know, with black male, white female, and white male, Asian female. It's just, it's not to say it's dysfunctional, but people are going their own way. You know, the whole MGTOW, the men going their own way. It's men uh-huh. being open about hating white women because white women have, you know, are into feminism and such. And now I feel as though that the reason why those interracial things are happening is because it's the only way out of a thing that's, it's unfortunate, but I think this is, if current trends continue, things like Asian Aryanism will happen. And when I mean Asian Aryanism, I'm also saying it's very whimsical because I imagine it like Rabbit's Alt-Left. Rabbit's Alt-Left has a space age kind of Stereolab, artsy 1960 view. I have this view that Asian Aryanism will be about like street culture and avant-garde punk things and jet set radio future and fun anime being real. But that's just me. I'm being artsy.
What I was going to say actually earlier is there's this beautiful quote by John Derbyshire about diversity. He says it's like a spice. In small amounts, it's a great thing. But if you pour like a bunch of spice into like a soup, it will completely ruin it. And uh-huh. I think a good example, I mean, it's like great being able to like go to like Japanese gardens and go out and like have sushi. But it's important at the same time. It's important to have like Western civilization, like having a dominant culture. So I totally agree with what John Derbyshire has to say on that.
I agree, and it comes down a lot of it. I mean, culturism is an art form as well as a science, and when I say science, I mean hard sciences. And a lot of it has to do with status. Status raises testosterone. And how do we know the status of the culture? Well, part of it is, again, we brag about it being the majority culture. We brag about it in high school. We brag about it on TV. Our president brags about it. Our churches brag about it. And then it becomes something that walks with swagger. And when it walks with swagger, it exudes testosterone, and therefore it gets women. And right now we're in this, and then it feeds back again. You have, if you get testosterone and swagger coming from thug life, then that encourages more people to go that way. And so Derbyshire is right. A little bit of spice is great, but you have to establish what is the top dog in your culture. Pecking orders, they're international, but they're also in a culture domestically. I'm sorry, I don't want to be like, I hope that you're following me here, but culturism is very well-rounded. You have to look at psychology, philosophy, history, natural science, anthropology, and advertising, and status, and sexuality, and evolutionary psychology to guide your culture. And culturism is about guiding society. So these things we're saying are true, and it's good to make, note them, like, a little spice is good, but we need more. It's good to be scientific about it and say, actually, it's good to have an alpha male so the spice doesn't get out of control. It's good to guide your morals. And it's good to not just sort of like talk about it, but be an active proponent of culture. Be an active culturist. And we need our institutions to do this. We need our government to do this. We need to do this individually and fight back so that we're not just making observations. We're actually being cultures, we're actually being active change agents.
This ties in with what we were talking about earlier with your involvement with the Tea Party.
Uh-huh.
If you look at compare European politics to American politics, the European nationalist parties from like the civic nationalist like UKIP to like the ethno-nationalist parties like Jobbik and Hungary,
uh-huh.
and these different, and then you have like Marine Le Pen who's somewhere in between. Their core issue is culturalism, but they can have different views. Like some parties might adopt like left-wing views. Some parties might be a little bit socialist. I think culturalism has to be the core issue. And I would say personally, I'm fairly centrist or even left-wing on a lot of issues, but I see culturism as a key issue. But what I've seen as this sort of American conservative movement is it's been a coalition of business interests, the religious right, and foreign mm-hmm. policy hawks. But the mainstream conservative movement, up until Trump, pretty much neglected culturism and national sovereignty.
Absolutely, because they believe in globalism, and they believe in this sort of economic man, and so they sort of shove it to the side, and we become very bureaucratic. Our government is not our culture. Our culture establishes our government, and our government is now committed to neutrality, right? It's this bureaucratic, almost economic view of man, and I say we not only not have to be multiculturalism is basically saying our government is neutral to our culture. France does this, right? We're not going to have a hijab, but you can't have a cross in public. You can't pray in school. Because we want to be neutral, right? We don't have any particular religion. We need to throw out this neutrality, this multiculturalism, this globalism, and again be cultures. We have a specific culture to protect and promote. And France has not only got to, just be neutral, they've got to promote Western values and Western history in their schools. I believe our politicians, and here, Trump is doing some of this. I like this, but he has to be, everyone feels pressure to say multicultural platitudes, right? But we have to, our government has to say, we are Western. We have a right to protect, a duty to protect ourselves, and if we don't protect our history. We have no future. So I'm against this sort of neutral bureaucratic vision of government.
You have an upcoming book about Matthew Arnold. He was a writer in Victorian England, and he coined the term culturism. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's actually already out, the book, and it's a very fun book. It's a fiction book. It's a fictional biography in which Matthew Arnold comes back to life, and he guides a suicidal 17-year-old American girl to psychological emotional health. So she's in trouble, and he comes as a spirit guide, and they go on a road trip, and they have adventures. Now, Matthew Arnold was called the culturist because he wanted to use education to guide society by having public schools and by having Christianity taught in the schools.
And you told me he was actually like atheist or agnostic, but he supported like the Church of England as a cultural institution, not for theological reasons.
This is why he was a culturist, not a theist. And he just said, look, religion is dying because people aren't going to believe in miracles because science is writing. He was very modernist, but he understood if we throw out our history, if we throw out our religion, which has guided us and united us for centuries, has proven its ability to do that, then what do we have? We have anarchy. So his most famous book is Culture and Anarchy. So yeah, he wanted to say, he said, look, treat the Bible like an ethical guide, like poetry that is able to move and unite us, that gives us cohesion and a sense of side. And, you know, I mean, he didn't write about it because it wasn't going on much, but, you know, if we saw ourselves as Christendom again, as opposed to Islam, then we would have a sense of unity. And he's saying, we need that. And even if you don't literally take the Bible true, we've got to be culturist and use it as a culturist tool and keep it uniting the West. So he was about this, and because he wasn't a theist, people called him a culturist, and that stuck, and it got into the Oxford English Dictionary for a few years because of his being called a culturist. And he was also said to practice culturism. The term died for a long time, and I revised it, but he's the originator.
And you mentioned your book. It's a fiction novel based on a true historical figure. I think it is crucial to be involved in cultural things like fiction writing, art, and music, because I think it's kind of like that quote by Andrew Breitbart, politics is downstream from culture. I've noticed a lot of people who are maybe on the right, they tend to focus on political endeavors, writing these kind of like academic books. Part of the reason that the left has been so successful in changing the culture is because they've been very active in like arts and music, and I think in fiction writing and film and all that, and I think that's very crucial.
It's part of the reason I wrote the song Grab 'Em by the Pussy. And again, you go to my website and see it, and it's more entertaining than my other videos because I'm singing and I'm goofy and it's catchy, you know, and absolutely, the arts are important. And I recently, before that, I did a video about art criticism. I mean, to see modern art as decline, to understand the history of the West through its art, to go to a Western art gallery and see that if you look back in our history, no, our art is not Asian, our art is not African mass. We have a culture, we have a history, a trajectory to protect. And you know, art is important. We have to be, Matthew Arnold, he was the Victorian England's third best poet, critics say, and he wrote about art criticism, and he wrote that art must be moral. It must motivate us to appreciate and want to protect and further our society. And attention to the arts, absolutely, very important.
Are you familiar with like the Italian futurists? They were an artistic movement and political, but they were both a nationalist, but also a modernist at the same time. And their work wasn't traditional. It was modern.
I like the Moving Train.
And also there's another artist like Wyndham Lewis. I think you can have artwork that's abstract, but also culturist, I don't think you have to be a radical traditionalist to be a culturist.
Definitely not, but I believe we made a big mistake when we went, I mean, it's a slippery slope, right? You start with, you know, having impressionism, which is not realism, but it's a little, and then you end up with just abstraction that looks good in hotels because it just could be belong to anybody. It offends nobody. It stands for nothing. It's just splotches of paint. It's just decoration. And I think that we made a mistake with when we rejected our like the Royal Academies of Art that you know were in every country, because art used to it was progressive. Yes, it would change. Yes, it would get, you know, you'd have revolutions against the older generation, but it was always done within a trajectory of Western culture. And I think we kind of peaked in a way in the 1890s when we had realist, dramatic, romantic, technically well done art that was modern but also spoke to our past.
And are you talking about like the French Impressionist?
The Raphaelites.
The Raphaelites, you know, the Shakespeare illustration of Ophelia would fit in there. But you know, even before that, where you have just Bouguereau and different artists, Alma Tadema, and you have in the Russians, you have different nationalist artists, and you have a real flowering in like the 1880s, and that's, you know, fin de siècle, they say, because then comes the break of modernism, and you lose the connection with tradition. And I'm for progress. I'm for new things. I'm through multimedia. I'm through doing arts. I'm for doing song. I make YouTube videos and stuff like this. But I think that it should always, it's richer for reaching back into our Western psyche, our Western heritage, and looking at Greek plays and invoking Christianity and talking about our icons, like, you know, Jesus and John the Baptist and Mary and these things that speak to us.
It seems that culturalism would help people getting back to the roots. However, what advice would you give for someone who might be racially mixed or kind of confused with their own identity, or just they don't? What if you have these self-loathing whites who feel that, oh, Western culture, it's bad and oppressive, or that they can't find things that they relate to, or at least someone who's, you know, racially half, or they're just confused on that part? How does someone uphold healthy cultural things? Is Christianity have something with that? Because I really like Christianity. I find that as a very helpful resource.
Well, Christianity as a part is one of the two main pillars of Western civilization. As Matthew Arnold says, we got Athens and Jerusalem. We've got science and we've got religion. We've got secular and religious. But I think it would just get past this race thing. Look, the West is something to be proud of. Your story is part of the Western story. It's very important that, like with people do with Christianity, that you see yourself as part of this story. It's not separate from you. And we created the car. We created the automobile. We created airplanes. We created the internet. We've created the individual. We've created living a life in a government that's guided by collective rational decisions of rational men. We have created so much that is wonderful. Take pride in being part of the West. Take pride, and even if you're mixed race, you can appreciate everything that we have created. Flight, right? The ability for me to speak to you on Skype right now. I mean, the funniest, saddest thing in the world, right, is somebody saying how evil Western civilization is on the internet, on Facebook, on a computer that was invented in the West.
Oh, yeah.
No, you're gonna be happy if you're less of a bitch and you're more of a celebrator, you know? Stop bitching and feel pride. And that, of course, you know, I mean, that creates a sense of duty. And that's like, for example, why it's so important to have culturism in the schools. Because if I say, if you don't do well in school, you're going to have a bad job, right? You're going to work at McDonald's. That's an individualist goal, right? So if I blow it off, I have a job at McDonald's. Whatever. I mean, you know, it's me. It's up to me. But if you take pride in, like, if the West falls, we go into barbarism. If the West falls, Sharia is going to come and you're going to understand hell in a level you never understood before. You must be proud of the West. You must also protect the West, understand how precious it is, and this gives you a sense of belonging. It gives you a sense of morals, more than just like, you know, you're going to end up working at McDonald's if you don't go to college. Your civilization is going to collapse if you don't do your duty and do well in school and respect your teachers and respect the institutions. And I would say to this mixed race person that you're talking about, hypothetical, get into the West. Take pride in it. It is wonderful.
Yeah.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank John Kenneth Press for being on. It's been an excellent show.
I've really enjoyed it. And please do go to www.culturism.us or Google Culturism and look at my videos. I got a lot of free videos. And spread the words culturism and culturism. One action you can take today, if somebody says, I believe in multiculturalism and you're a racist, don't just say, I'm not racist. Say, look, I'm culturist. And if we believe in cultural diversity, let's talk about how great ours is and how crappy others are. Let's be honest about it, okay?
Yes.
And spread the word. Get that meme out there, because if we can get people not afraid to be called a racist all the time and able to speak aggressively and offensively, go on the offense about, you know, Western culture, that's going to help us. So please spread the words culturism and culturist today.